Hello and welcome to episode 44 of the AGS podcast, also known as the Blue Cup Tools podcast, I think. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grundislav, and with me as always...
Hello, I am Ben Stadler, also known as Ben304, and with us, for the very first time, is a very special guest. Hello, Andale, and welcome to the Blue Cup Tools podcast.
Hello, and thank you.
Andale, also known as Petter... Petter, because I always butcher your last name because I'm an ass.
No, that's fine. That's what foreigners do when they see the L and J combined in that way.
Is it Ljungqvist from what I remember?
Yeah.
Hey,
very good.
My 10-year-old memory from Mittens 2004 still serves me well.
Oh yeah, it is 10 years, isn't it? That's quite fascinating.
It's depressing. We're old.
I was still in school.
You baby.
In my world, we're all the same age. So,
oh
yeah, so a decade ago, that's like a third of my lifetime.
Yeah. Anyway, how are you? How are you, Petter? How are you this fine spring day?
Actually, I'm really good. And yes, it is a very fine spring day here too. It's a bit cold, but the sun is shining and everything is green and, you know, just wonderful. And I'm allergic as a result.
So oh, dear.
My nose is a bit stuffed, in case you wonder.
Well, my nose is stuffed too, but it's because I've had a cold for the past week. And I got sunburned yesterday because I went out. I went out on a goth date, but it wasn't very gothy because it was sunny. But I did go to.
Did you hiss at the sun?
I did, actually.
Good.
I did, yeah. Excellent. At the very beginning, we commented on how it was actually sunny, and I went. But I went
to. Was it like a blind date?
No. It wasn't a blind date. It was just. We went to the park and we went to the cemetery, so we said it was a goth date.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
very good. You're not known for dating goths, Francisco, even though you've been a goth for an hour or so yourself.
We don't talk about that.
No, I do. I relish in it. Anyway,
yeah, I know you.
Congratulations,
relish. Goddamn hot.
Congratulations,
yeah.
to Petter on the release of the Samaritan Paradox.
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Regular listeners will be aware that both Francisco and I played it pretty much the weekend it came out. So you know, we both enjoyed it and. And we're here to talk about that mostly, I think.
And Ben actually played it while we were recording that episode of the podcast. So
I couldn't stop playing it. I thought I'm gonna solve these puzzles.
That was
no matter
very.
What.
I'm very honored that you spent time on doing that simultaneously, and I'm also a bit impressed that you managed to some degree.
I'm always playing games or painting while we do the podcast. I'm very much a multi-task person. But anyway, congratulations on the release. It's a great game. It's been all the feedback that I've heard so far from everyone I've talked to that's played it has been great. You know, people are really impressed, especially considering, you know, your first commercial release and the first game you released in ages. How long has it been since your last game?
Oh dear. I made a game which was part of a thesis, actually, for the when I still studied, and that was some kind of experiment in language acquisition through playing video games, which was a very short, and I don't know if you, I think
it, I remember it was fun. I thought it was clever.
It was kind of short, and I guess it could have been something someday. and before that was like. It must have been in 2001 or two something when I made like a fantasy trilogy of inferior quality in retrospect, and even just a few months after release, I looked back at it and kind of I wasn't ashamed, but I wasn't very satisfied either.
I remember those were the Tools World games.
Correct, Francisco.
I remember those as well.
So I'm happy to have something new that people will remember me by in game terms. so that's quite fun. And the the feedback so far has been largely positive, and I think it's not considering that I'm a solo in this field, but perhaps thanks to that, because I've managed to kind of pass under the radar of where people usually start to find faults and flaws, and people are quite forgiving now when they know that I did this on my own, and it's a low budget kind of a indie game, so it feels pretty good so far.
Uh-huh. Good. I think one thing that particularly impressed me, and Francisco and I were talking about this, is how you managed to find a style that not only looked good but was sort of efficient enough to produce that you could sort of handle a project of this scale all on your own. You know, did you sit around for a while and try and figure out how you're going to pull it off, or did it just come to you?
Every time you try a new style or a new method, you have to find some kind of system, some kind of method, and I made a few, like a dozen or so backgrounds where I still didn't really know where this would take me or what it would result in, and after that I managed to make some kind of a bandwagon process where I started I would start usually in SketchUp just to get the perspective right, and then I would just not really pixelate it, but you know, some kind of zoomed in painting. I don't know if there was a particular method I used, or I just kind of winged it in a bit. Mm-hmm. So
I recognize at least one of the backgrounds from several years ago when you did a tutorial. I'm sure you know which one I mean. That was
like a little Easter egg kind of.
I really like that. That was kind of nostalgic for me. Like, I felt like, oh, I'm, you know, like, only people who are around the AGS forums of that time will sort of get that, I think. And I was like, oh, that feels kind of special.
Jeez, what an elitist you are.
Yeah. That's me. I'm so sorry.
I think you were talking to me.
Not you, Petter. You're not an elitist. No.
You're fine. I thought I was being the elitist for including the reference.
No.
Okay.
No.
Stop upsetting the guests, Francisco.
It's what I do.
I know. I've noticed.
Yes. Anyway,
that's why I'm here.
Yeah. So when I played a beta a while ago, you told me that you had been working on the game for about a year and a half or so.
Well, yes.
When did you?
So roughly almost 2 years now. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. When did you decide that you were going to make a commercial from the outset, or did you sort of?
I did. Yeah.
It
ended up pretty much like I had planned it to do, and it's basically the length and the scope that I had planned for, and I wanted it to be a commercial release, so I knew basically everything was as it looked on the drawing board, sort of.
Cool.
That's pretty impressive dedication to a vision, I think. That's awesome. Yeah, because a lot of the times, you know, you get a thing, you go, oh, that's a bit hard. I'll compromise here and I'll compromise there. You know, so that's...
Oh,
I
definitely think that you should allow yourself to just go with a sudden whim or some kind of, you know, sudden... a flash of inspiration, because that's what sometimes makes it more original, and it feels like it's a more dynamic thing. I'm certainly not the kind of guy who writes down everything and then just, you know, just follow it point to point. But the outlines are there, and the key plot elements were there. I knew that I wanted the ending to be roughly like that, and uh-huh. I'm not sure if I should spoil stuff now, but
well, if you haven't, if you're listening and you haven't played the Samaritan Paradox, turn off the podcast, go play the Samaritan Paradox, and then come back and listen. Because
come back.
Yeah,
come back. Yeah. It's worth playing, and it'll be worth having the discussion that we, you know, yeah. Now that we've got yes. you here,
and it's our podcast, yeah, we can talk about whatever the hell we want, and if we want to spoil the game, we can spoil the game. So
yeah, so let's spoil the game.
Yeah,
but the reason. Then,
excuse me.
For me wanting to explain this is that some feedback I've received has been about how the ending felt very abrupt and kind of unexpected, which I perfectly can understand and agree on, but the events that take place. They were there in my original plans, so that wasn't a sudden kind of I want a really spectacular twist, so let's throw uh-huh. the worst possible thing into the mix.
mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like that. I knew that I wanted the father to have this past, to have this crime on his conscience, and I uh-huh. And that there would be an incestuous affair inside the family. But then and I wanted this because the game is largely about sin and guilt, and that's possibly the worst kind of atrocity. It wouldn't be enough with shady weapons deals with dictatorships somewhere in the third world. I needed something much more, something much more gripping, something more controversial.
Yeah, something personal like that is usually much more sort of immersive, I think, or shocking than something on a global scale where people, like a standard player, can't really relate to like weapons deals and that.
Yeah, so that thing has always been there, and how it was presented eventually in the finished product, I could have probably done something more to kind of build up to that moment, and I could have made something. It turned out a bit of a compromise, which I think I wrote in somewhere in a hide in a spoiler.
In a spoiler,
So I originally I wanted the game to be even more perhaps anti-climactic, with a very sudden ending where Ord basically just went back to his earlier life, and nothing would really have been resolved or
yeah. I read that post of yours, and I actually thought that was quite interesting. Like, if you don't really, I mean, usually you didn't go for the cheesy Hollywood ending or anything like that, but most games, they have like some sort of resolution, you have a resolution in your game, but to have just like a total anti-climax for this whole thing, especially in contrast to like the more or less epic fantasy story, like you said, the contrast of real life, how like not everything has a happy ending, not all questions get answered.
Yeah.
I thought that seems like a really interesting avenue to explore.
Yeah,
actually,
so maybe I should have been more. I should have gone for that instead of, because now it's a bit of a. I can understand if a player feels like the game doesn't really know where to go or where to end. It's like, is it this or is it that? Is it a sudden tragedy kind of twist, or is it some sort of happy ending? Because even though there is something that at least resembles a happy ending, because we assume that they will go away together and start mm-hmm. something,
mm.
and but we don't know really if like how is she feeling, what's her state now,
yeah.
and what happened to this to her memories.
Yeah,
and that makes it a bit. I guess it can be even a bit I don't know, a bit weird. Some people even interpret it as if she was pregnant with her father's child.
Oh,
which
oh,
is
no,
and,
God,
yeah,
no,
and that that's a bit too, I mean, that's a bit too dark even for this game. I certainly didn't intend for it to be that.
The fact that she'd been kind of estranged and hadn't talked to him for a while. So, you know, there wasn't, I think you made that pretty clear that it wasn't his child for me anyway.
Yeah, and in my, I think if we have, if we're being a bit realistic, you can't really suppress memories from like a few years back.
Yeah.
You probably, it probably belongs to a childhood period where she was very, yeah, very small.
Mm-hmm.
But what's in the game is in the game, and it's being presented, yeah, this way. So if people interpret it one way or another, who am I to argue about that?
Yeah, someone also brought up the point where, like, you know, the game starts and Ord is like, oh man, my rent is due, blah, 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 and he never gets any money, so how's he going to pay his rent?
Yeah, maybe that's why he goes away.
Yeah,
so. This is an interesting point that you made that I really like, is you've got stuff like the dinner date on Friday with Magnus, and
oh,
you've,
yeah,
got the unpaid rent, and like the basement door, the cellar door that you never get to go down into. I really love the fact that you gave this impression of a larger world, like that there's more to the game than just what's essential to tell that one little story, you know? I really like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and I think if I hadn't almost overdone it, if I had only had like one or two of those occasions, I think that it would have felt like an unfinished game. But now, when it was more of a recurring theme that they talk about things that will take place afterwards, or things that have taken place already. So I hope that people feel like that's a part of the game. Of the theme, sort of, that you have. This is like you open a small, it's like you open a door and you just look into this, mm-hmm, this little, these 3 days of Ord's life, and you have things before and things outside and things afterwards. So that was my intention. And obviously some people will feel a bit robbed, you know, like what happened to them? Like why couldn't I enter the damn basement? And so, sorry for that.
See, no, you don't apologize for that. That's where you say, well, that's up to your interpretation.
Yeah.
And then it makes you,
well, I guess it is.
Well, of course it is. What are you, yeah, Roger Ebert? Video games can be art.
I'm alive.
Yeah. Oh,
but yeah, I think it was. Well, that's true. That's true. It was funny because Ashton Reyes, who actually reviewed it for the Telegraph, was playing it, and he and I were discussing the game while he was playing it. And I said, I don't want to talk about it too much because when the twist comes, you know, it's really worth waiting for it and not knowing anything about it. And when he finished the game, he said, "There's one issue I have with this game." And I said, "What's that?" He said, I never found out about the dinner date with Magnus. And when you actually wrote your explanation on the forum, this was before he'd written his review, I linked him to it, and he was very, very pleased that you recognised it as a thing, you know, as something that you'd intentionally done that. So, you know, it's not just me that noticed that, you know. I think it's quite a good thing that you did there.
Yeah, and also I don't really know how exciting it would be. All right, let's add one day just to meet Magnus, and they would have a coffee or something. I don't know if, yeah, that would add very much to the game, but maybe I'll make a sequel and just, you know, here's the damn
coffee.
Yeah, coffee with Magnus.
I think
no puzzles or anything.
Oh, in terms of a character study, your whole intent, I guess, was to show not only, like, the story in the book and what that relates to, but also Ord's progression from one part of his life to another part of his life. And as a character study, I don't think you need to go further than that in showing what happened to him. You don't need to sort of push, in my opinion. Once you've shown that, that's it. The story, that part of his story is over, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's how I feel about it.
Well, you said about Coffee with Magnus not having any puzzles, which is an excellent segue to talk about, you know me and my segues,
yes,
to talk about puzzles, because you have some really interesting puzzles in your game, and they're not your typical adventure game stupid puzzles that I've been ranting about lately, like, you know, stick
I think that
a
depends on
to a cockroach.
Whom you ask, but yeah.
Well, You're okay. I mean, your puzzles, yeah, there's a few of them that are a little outside the box, but they really are more riddle puzzles. They're not so much like, you know, ridiculous inventory combination, just like, you know, They're grounded in the game's logic. And obviously you take advantage of the fact that, you know, you established that this guy was into puzzles and riddles and stuff like that. So you can get away with having, you know, just kind of obscure logic. But
I think without that logic, it would be completely impossible. I have no idea anymore how I would ever design an adventure game without something like that, because it feels like, Jesus, how am I going to like have anything that's even fun to solve if it's just going to be, you know, another like open the panel using a nickel or something like that.
Well, one thing that I thought was kind of interesting and that I'm slightly a little disappointed about was that you establish Ord as a cryptographer, and the only real cryptographer like code breaking puzzles at the very start of the game. I was kind of hoping maybe for like a cipher or something later on. Unless I'm misremembering,
obviously my first thought was that okay, this is going to be about a code break, so there will be codes and ciphers, and he will substitute numbers for letters, etc.
Sure.
And then I was afraid that it would turn out kind of dry, kind of like some kind of I don't know, edutainment thing where people were, okay, that game is about ciphers. And so I basically scrapped most of those. And there are only a few places where he uses his code breaking skills. So I guess that's a bit of I'm not really using the fact that he has a certain profile, a certain skill. So yeah, I could have definitely done more of that. Maybe I could have got rid of some of the sillier puzzles and made them into something more of a code.
Well, I mean, also as it relates to the story too. I mean, if he's doing this treasure hunt that the guy designed for his daughter, and his daughter's not a code breaker, so I mean, if he had made it too complicated, then he would have expected that she wasn't going to find it.
Point.
So,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
You said before how you can't really imagine how you design adventure game puzzles without like having that sort of riddles thing there. But I actually enjoyed even the puzzles where you're playing as Ord and you're not trying to get past the riddles. But when you're doing stuff like, you know, getting through the boat and getting through the warehouse and that sort of stuff, I really thought you did that pretty well. Like, you pulled that off quite well compared to how I've seen other designers do that. So I think you've got a pretty good sense of puzzle design, you know?
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. I don't agree 100%. I definitely think that some puzzles, in retrospect, I think some of them turned out too silly for a mainstream audience. Perhaps that's too much because we don't have anything like that. But for most players, some of the puzzles I think are a bit too far fetched and as I said, I have a really hard time. I know that my next game, which I've already begun sketching on, won't have that kind of gameplay where you combine A with B and you kind of unexpectedly get something, C. Mm-hmm. That's what I don't want anyway. No. I don't know what it will look like. I'm having huge problems now trying to come up with what will it be like? Because if a puzzle isn't silly, or at least not a bit overly contrived, like the various Jonathan contraptions in the game. And if the puzzle won't be very mundane and you know, use screwdriver on a screw or use a saw on a branch, then what is a puzzle? I don't think that I'm inherently a good puzzle designer, because I have huge troubles finding these interesting twists on everyday stuff, everyday objects or everyday problems. So I'm a bit nervous when it comes to designing my next game, because I don't know how I will tackle that at all.
I'm glad that you're designing more games. That's always a good thing.
Yeah, that's good news.
Yeah. But yeah. I agree with you. Puzzle design is always something that makes me nervous too, because yeah, there is that balance between you don't want to make things, like you say, too obvious and too mundane, because then people don't think your game is challenging enough, and then versus putting something in that's too difficult and then people get stuck and
yeah. I think I have perhaps one maxim that I eventually came up with or developed, apart from trying to just make the puzzles varied, because that was one of my, you know, one of my motivations to have a puzzle like for everyone. One puzzle can be purely logical and one can be like a bit more Monkey Island-esque. But I think a good rule of thumb is to make sure that the player knows roughly what to do, but not how to do it. And I think that's a vast difference between not being really sure of how to solve a problem and not knowing what the problem is. And I Absolutely. Think as long as you can direct the player to, it's like you lead a horse to the water, and then he will have to drink for himself. But as long as you direct the player somehow, so I try to at least set up all the puzzles in a way so that the player should have everything that's necessary to solve it, all the threads and all the levers or whatever, like in his, you know, proximity, and give him a sense of what should be done. I know I didn't succeed all the times. I know that there are some instances where the player would probably just wander around for a while, not knowing exactly what to do. But if you want to keep the player a bit engaged and enthusiastic, I think that's a good thing to keep in mind, to at least make the player aware of what the problem is and what the puzzle is, etc.
Yeah, as long as
I think having the notebook really helps that, because if a player misses a line of dialogue or isn't paying attention, you've got this little indicator there of, oh, this is something I meant to look into, you know, or this is unresolved. I think that kind of helps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you have a complex puzzle, if you have just, you know, clues, not outright hints, but just clues available, like I'm thinking of the Kane bunker puzzle, which had had me stumped for a while, had Ben stumped for a while too.
Yes.
But you do have all of the, I mean, it's not one of those puzzles that you know, you see it, and at first I thought, oh, this requires outside knowledge, and I had to go to Wikipedia and look up, you know, if it was, because I couldn't remember if it was 10 or 12 labors for Hercules. But if you go to the library, you can actually get all of the clues you need for the puzzle, which I found out later when I was trying to figure out why 7 C's didn't work. And nasty man. I just wanted to say that was a good aha moment. I really enjoyed that bit.
I was lucky enough to have been in the library and sort of, I love clicking on books and reading books in games, same with Tombstone, so I tried to read all the books, so I sort of knew that was there, so I'm like, oh, well, there's hints in the game available to me, you know.
Are you the kind of guy who looks through the entire library in every room in Baldur's Gate?
Absolutely. That's me.
Oh, dear.
Okay. So I just wondered if they wrote all that literature for someone, or if they catered for someone, but okay, so there are players who actually browse through everything.
I'm that guy.
It makes me happy that all that text isn't for nothing.
Yeah, well, you look at a game like Planescape Torment, which you know, where's the jar? And if you're that sort of player, you know, you can spend forever. There's one bar in the city that I spent an hour just reading everything. So yeah. Games that cater to that sort of player especially take up a lot of my time. But yeah, I like that. You know, if you put the effort in, there'll be at least one person. I love it when I hide an Easter egg and there's only one person that finds it and they email me. I love that. That's the best thing. Yeah. So, yeah, there'll always be someone that'll check that stuff out.
Yeah.
So, aside from puzzles, there was something else I was going to talk about, but my sleep-deprived brain has forgotten. So,
but while you're thinking of that, let's talk about the production process. Did you give yourself lists of tasks and did you set schedules for yourself, or did you just kind of sit down and work on it as you felt like it?
Yeah, both, I guess. As I said, I'm not a very organized person, and I'm certainly not one to have a huge bullet point list where I cross things out. The only times I did that was while bug testing, basically, because if you don't write down the bugs you encounter, you're completely lost.
Oh yes.
But apart from that, no. I try to think in segments, so I try to have a few rooms at a time that I worked on parallel, so I wouldn't get bored, and also I would try to keep in. I try to be somewhat consistent in style, and then I try to work on one segment at a time, and apart from that, I just had a vague mental vision of what I needed to do. So I'm not very organized, and I hope that if I end up working together with someone, which is my ambition now, I hope that that person will be much more organized. And if I team up with a programmer, they tend to always be more organized and structured, sort of inherently. So I hope that I can take care of other things.
Speaking of which, I've heard rumors flying around that you and Joel Stavhasto are going to team up or thinking of teaming up together. Are you at liberty to comment on that, or is that still
at least I can say that that's something that we have talked about, and I would love to do it. Now, unfortunately, he's still working on his game, Cathy Rain, which, by the way, is a very promising game.
Very, very promising.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that will take, I mean, this year, and I don't know how much longer. So, and so that's obviously a problem, and I don't want to, you know, interfere or delay that process. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty eager to start on my next project quite soon,
sure,
because I'm so fed up with TSP and I'm so I nearly hit a wall there for a while towards the end, and I need to do something now. I need to make something radically different. I need to make something high res. Without all the without the cumbersome dialogue and all the you know, contrived puzzles and complicated family affairs, I want to do something much more naked, something more existential, I guess, something more metaphorical, perhaps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's I think for my own peace of mind, I need to start working on that, because I want to put the Samaritan Paradox behind me, like mentally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Oh, I remember now what I was going to ask you, just as a personal thing when we're talking about puzzles, because I played the beta. I played a little bit of the beta a while ago.
Yeah.
And I remember you could order chicken from the cafeteria. Now, don't get me wrong, but it was did you substitute the gas for the chicken? Oh, okay. That's what I thought.
Yeah,
I think you made the right choice.
I can tell you this much: without any testers, my game would have been so much harder.
Mm.
And and that's it's a bit interesting now, because when I started planning, I didn't intend for the game to be very difficult. So I didn't sit down and say, all the games these days are so freaking easy, I'm going to make a hard game. That's not how I thought. I just wanted to make a grown-up theme. That was my only kind of, you know, that would be the selling point of the game, to have an adult kind of a story. And apart from that, I just started designing puzzles. And I thought, this is probably not too hard or too easy. And then some of the puzzles turned out to be vicious. And that was one of the more hard in a silly way puzzles, because instead of using the mace or the gas in the ventilation box, you would order a chicken, and while it was still warm, because it was a timed event, which thankfully didn't, you know, stay, because people hate timed events. You would place it there instead, because if you had eavesdropped prior to that, you would have heard that the guard was complaining about being hungry, so that was your clue.
Yeah, he still does.
So now
the poor guy is not only hungry, but you mace him too. You just Ordis a cruel, cruel man.
Hard luck for that guy.
So those who tested that segment said that that's just too hard. And there are some other things where I've simplified the puzzle so much, I guess I could have implemented a difficulty setting or something. The original Constellation/chess puzzle, it didn't even have a picture of the harpy, because if you look at the chess the lid, there's the picture of a harpy, so you know what to look for. And the initial puzzle didn't have that, so you would basically have to connect the chess riddle, the one with the eight queens, yes. And you would understand that the constellation you're looking for is the only one that fits the solution to that puzzle. So that would be your only clue, basically. So tough yes, it, yeah, that would have been very. Very tough, and I think it's a side effect of not having played many games recently, because you kind of lose your point of reference. I don't know any longer what's a standard puzzle in terms of difficulty, because I haven't played that many games, which is obviously a huge disadvantage when you design a game, because you lose your perspective in a while. So that's why having testers is so important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I thought it was funny too, because the beta came with a walkthrough, and it was a pretty detailed walkthrough, but for a couple of puzzles like the horse, which gave me a little bit of trouble at the beginning, and the cane, it's just like, here's the horse puzzle. Listen to the poem if you need some clues. Or, here's the cane. Use the calendar for hints. I'm like, but I need more. I'm stupid. But we got it in the end.
There are also some purely, like, mechanical things that you need to understand. How the horse dial, it works like a safe dial where you change directions.
Yeah, sure.
And the cane, you have to wait for the click. Things like that, people screw that up. So yeah.
I thought the horse was pretty self-explanatory, but the cane with the clicking, it took me a little while to figure out, is the clicking because I've gone too slow, or do I need, you know, that took me a while. But I think that was fairly self-explanatory, like how the mechanic of it works. I have a question. Like, you say you don't play games very much, but when you play a game, is there a certain thing that inspires you and that you try to instill in your own game?
it's funny because recently, though, I don't know if you spend much time on the forums any longer, but there was recently a background competition which Snarky hosted, and the theme was from here to there or something like that.
I actually have entered the competition.
Oh yeah, you did. Sorry, you participated. Yeah. Yeah. Nice background, by the way. It's
thank you.
It was very, very impressive. And he said something I think towards the end, he said something like, because this has been a very I've always been intrigued by having a piece of walkable area somewhere and you don't know how to access it. And it awoke something within me, because I realized that when I was young and I started playing the early Sierra titles, the exploration itself was the what I found so magical about it. It was what I dreamt about. I dreamt about being able to, you know, open a door and discovering a brand new area. And I dreamt about being able to stop. Do you remember the first police quest where you drive around in Lytton?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I just wanted to be able to stop next to a building that looked interesting and just get this whole new scene to explore. And so I realized now how important I find this exploration part about seeing something and not knowing how to access it, and then suddenly finding the way. And that's something I didn't have that in TSP, and I'm a bit disappointed now afterwards that I should have had that thing, that element of exploration, and I definitely will use it in my next game.
Well, it gives you something new to work with.
Yeah, I think if you had included that, I think really the only place it would have felt, I guess, appropriate would have been in the fantasy world, because I mean Ord's world is very self-contained and very he seems like the type of guy that doesn't get out much and wouldn't really go exploring. So
that's a fair point, but apart from that, it's when you start making something on your own, you just realize how incredibly difficult it is to get everything right. And I've looked at games that have been, you know, lauded for their literary qualities, and I've listened to the dialogue and I've read the text messages, and I thought, okay, it's good, but it's not a literary masterpiece. And after having made my own game, I just realized how extremely well written those games. I'm not going to name names now, but I realize now how extremely hard it is to write authentic sounding dialogue, and to I'm rather used to writing, you know, fiction, like traditional, just texts.
Prose.
Yeah, precisely, just standard prose. Mm-hmm. But this is when you write for a game, it's more of a movie script kind of a thing, and I was very unused to that, and I appreciate now looking at movies now, I can appreciate the art of writing dialogue in a way that I had never done before. So I really woke up in that sense.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you too, because we kind of touched on this when we were talking about the game the last podcast or whenever we were talking about it. But you had the luxury, which is a luxury that I have myself with my game that I'm working on. Which is that, you know, you're doing all the art, you did all the art and everything, so you're not paying per background or anything, so you can kind of get away with having excess, not necessarily 100% useful for everything backgrounds. And I'm talking mostly about like the exterior shots of like you know, the iron square and the overpass or the underpass under the bridge and stuff like that, which are pretty, and they really are great to set. You know, as they're very cinematic and they're very good establishing shots. But aside from just kind of being a portal between the map screen and the interior that you're going to, they don't really serve all that much purpose. You didn't do too much of that. You only really had those two screens in Gothenburg. But did you find that you kind of wanted to do more of that to like show off the city a little bit more, or?
Did Yes, I probably should have done that, but you're very correct in the sense that when you do your own backgrounds, you don't have to be that economical, which I think is a benefit, because having too much content in too few scenes can probably, I think it can make the player feel a bit, I don't know, claustrophobic or something, because it feels like everything is just taking place between the same few scenes. I definitely think that there are some games that suffer from that, having, you know, and still, I guess it can also be the opposite, where you feel like you have just like graphic fillers in a way. Okay, just another, mm-hmm. just another park. It's just passing by.
Yeah,
but I definitely should have painted more Gothenburg. I should have painted more famous locations to get to get the city.
Well, I mean, I didn't feel it was lacking. I'm just curious, because like, I mean, I mentioned that there was a scene in Ben Jordan 8 that was like the outside of the Sacré-Cœur Cathedral, which served no purpose but to say, "Hey, look, it's a pretty church," mm-hmm. and I got rid of it because it was boring. Or, you know, just there was no purpose.
Didn't you have British Museum as well, an exterior shot? Or was it just interior?
The British Museum? I had a... was it the British Museum? I don't even remember.
The library.
There was the reading room thing. No, I never did an exterior shot of that, but... I had another interior shot when you go to the Waterloo Station of, like, the train ticket area, which was ridiculous and completely unnecessary also, that I got rid of, but I have a few establishing shots that really don't serve any purpose either, but I just, you know, it kind of breaks up the monotony from just being indoors and then on a
map. Absolutely, yeah. I guess you feel that you want to use backgrounds a lot because you have invested time and energy, and you probably don't want to spend too much time on a background that will only be an establishing shot. But in the end result, I think it's very important. I think it certainly isn't wasted time to have those scenes. I think they do a lot.
Exactly. Yeah. Eric Fierstein, back when he was making AGS games, always used to say that like, it really was a waste of time to just put so much time and effort into a background that was only going to be used for a cutscene for like 2 seconds or anything. But I agree with what you say. Sometimes you have to make that compromise. It's like when you do an animation that's, you know, 50 frames or something, and you have to put all this effort into it, and it's only in the game for like 2 seconds.
But, yeah, that's the price we pay. That's what we do, and animation is a perfect example, because it takes like you blink and you miss it, and I spent a whole afternoon just, you know, creating that damn loop, it's a horrible ratio between creating it and appreciating it afterwards.
I think sometimes the worth of something like that can't be just put down to like the amount of time it is on the screen, because it stays with you for, you know, like especially the Gothenburg shots. If you'd just done the city as a series of indoor shots, it wouldn't really evoke the sense. And the same with animations, you know, if you say, oh, this person died, big deal. But if you show them getting shot, or, you know, this person did this or this person did that, it actually adds more than the 2 seconds it's on the screen for. It actually, it helps build the experience over the long term.
So. Yeah, but then again, you have to draw the line somewhere, and if it's just a hobby project and it's perhaps not a very large game to start with, you have more room to just experiment and go for it. But if, like me, I was doing this on my own and I had some kind of deadline, and I wanted it to be a commercial thing. So in that sense, time is money, and there's a time limit on everything. And it's a bit sad now that I knew that. I mean, I could take any one of my backgrounds and I could if I spent a few more days on it, it would be much prettier. And that's just I always had to stop eventually. It was I had like maybe 5 hours per background or something. I don't know exactly. And then you just have to stop, which is both, I guess, a bit. It's nice to know that that there's no chance in hell I can even try to pursue that kind of perfection. But also it's a bit depressing that now that the finished product is out there, there's tons of graphics that I know now that if I had just had more time and resources, I could have made it much prettier to look at.
Well, that's just the curse. I mean, you know, we're always going to go back and look at stuff we've done and be like, oh, if only I could have done this, if only I could have done that. I mean, I personally think that everything looked really good. I mean, it worked. It was functional. All the animations were nice. It was a nice touch to have them all. The backgrounds were nice too. There was nothing in there that made me think, oh, he did that in 2 seconds or anything like that, you know, which is not what you want people thinking when they play your games. But I thought it was really good.
Okay, I think the important thing as well is not only just making it look good, but making it look consistent.
Yeah.
That's the main thing, you know. Have a sense of consistency to your style.
Mm. Yeah, I think we talked about that, Ben. But how I think the perfect example is Gemini Roo, where he had this perfect method of making something that was really time efficient. It was very consistent, and it was really pretty. And I think he said that some backgrounds they took like 20 minutes to make, and you wouldn't guess that because they look really nice, and so he ended up with something that he thought would just be quick and efficient, and it ended up perhaps being one of the strong points of the entire game, the graphic style.
I think the same with like the backgrounds that you did and the backgrounds that he did, and anything where you've got one artist trying to do everything all by himself as well as a bunch of other things, you'll find that people have, you know, if you've developed a sense of what looks good, even though you think it's unpolished, you've got a sense of what holds together and what you can sort of get away with. And so even though you might have not worked a thing to your full potential, your experience comes through and lets you sort of know when to stop and go, that's enough. And Josh had a great style for. I mean, you can see what he's done in terms of, you know, where he's not overcomplicated anything, you know, and in terms of like, you know, of room diversity and stuff like that. He's obviously set out to make a game and finish it. And finishing a big project is one of the hardest things, like as you'll probably know now. You know, it's hard to stick with a project, especially when you get to like that 3/4 way done mark and you hit that wall and you go, oh man, I'm sick of this.
That's where I am.
Oh, but Francisco, you have you have 10 at least 10 games that could count as full length. I think that must help to know. I discussed this earlier with someone, but having done something and having a routine is a huge psychological advantage, because when you're about to hit this brick wall and you just lose all hope and all inspiration, you know what the end result will be roughly. Which is how I feel when I'm drawing backgrounds now. A few minutes into the picture, there will be this kind of this uneasy feeling, like, is this, am I doing this the right way? Will this end up being something? But thanks to having done, I don't know how many damn backgrounds I've done in my days, but thanks to that experience, I know what the path is like, and I know what obstacles there are. And I think for you, Francisco, because you have all those games under your belt. You know, you know about all the ups and downs, and you know what the now, even though this is arguably a larger project in a sense, because you have you have another scope now, and it's your first commercial game, I guess. I think.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So that puts it obviously in a different light.
Yeah. I mean, I do, like you said, I do know the ups and downs. I've had the experience, but for me, every time I start a new game or even a new background or anything, I always just have that same feeling of like, I don't know what I'm doing. How is this gonna? You know, I always used to say, like, when I was working on the Ben Jordan games, like, there would reach a point where I would just think, I'm being too ambitious. I'm never going to finish this project. And then somehow it would be finished. And then I'd look back and think, how the hell did I do that?
So, yeah. But it's very impressive since you're in the graphics department, if I may say so, it feels like you've always been kind of just soldering on in a bit, because it's I don't think perhaps drawing backgrounds is what you thought you would be doing, perhaps, or what's easiest for you.
But definitely been a learning process, so I've definitely gotten a lot more comfortable with drawing backgrounds. I mean, when I started making games, I've never been a great artist in any medium. I mean, even though I've taken like art classes and stuff, my problem is I'm lazy. I'm not disciplined like Ben, who paints like, you know, every single day for like an hour or whatever, you know. So I just kind of do it whenever I feel like it. And as such, I haven't really grown probably as much as I could if I put time and effort into it. But I mean, I think, you know, it's taken me a while, but I finally have found a style that I'm more or less comfortable with. And I mean, I'm always willing to grow and improve and stuff. But yeah, I mean, for this last game, like, Ben Jordan 8 took me 4 years, partly because of the stupid method that I decided to try for the backgrounds. And instead of just early on realizing, oh, this is too time consuming, I'm just going to do it the old way.
Yeah, do you think that you will? Because I think that for me, I think game creation for me will be very kind of cyclical in a way. This game turned out to be kind of complicated, lots of plot, you know, lines everywhere, lots of everything, basically lots of puzzles. It's a bit silly, this and that, and now I want to do something distinctly different. And I was going to ask you, because you've made a number 8 Ben Jordan games. They were very obviously very similar in style, even though the last game turned out to be much sort of grander in scale. But do you sometimes get this urge to just make something completely different, something like extremely minimalist or like experimental or something?
Yeah, sure. And I have. I mean, I've always talked about the idea of the sorbet game, when, you know, you're sick of your project, you kind of cleanse your palate a little bit by working on something, just whatever. And, you know, I made Backdoor Man, which is pretty different to Ben Jordan.
At least in terms of in the plot department.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as far as if you mean like just making something completely different graphics wise, no, I haven't really thought about doing that. But just like, yeah, I mean, every now and then I take a break and I do something, make a little game, you know, enter Mags or something. I made Bertha Butt's Boogie, which was a nice, bright, colorful, silly game, and, you know, worked on Spaceman in Space with Ben, which was also a nice, colorful, silly game. And okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, you do little changes. My next game, I mean, obviously, you know, Golden Wake is nice, bright, sunny. You know, all the backgrounds except for maybe one are during the day, and they're all bright and sunny and cheerful. And the next game that I want to work on, not counting the one that I'm working on with Ben, my next project that I'm already thinking about, I'm totally going to set it at night, and it's just going to be dark and gloomy, and you know. So yeah,
but your sci-fi, the thing you do with Ben feels that the little I've seen, you released something in this.
We did release something. Yeah, and also did the One Room, 1 Week games.
Oh yeah. And that looked really dark already. So perhaps you will get your fix there.
I'm not really counting that because I'm not doing the backgrounds. Ben's doing all the art. So I'm just doing the writing and stuff. So it's not. I mean, I'll get to.
It's interesting that you say that because it might seem like a trivial thing to have many night scenes, but it's very different it's a completely different thing doing lots of making exterior shots and making interiors if you're making a fantasy game where with lots of forests and hills and whatnot and making a like a contemporary mostly indoor game, it's I don't think most non-artists realize what a different thing it is to draw those
things. I mean, yeah, you obviously had that experience within your own game because you had your parallel stories in completely different worlds, so
and I think there are some styles. For instance, I was very curious to see how you would handle all the offices and all the bedrooms with all the straight lines and all the desks and door frames and everything, because it seems like I might be assuming things, but it seems like you're the most in your element when you can make irregular, a bit asymmetrical shapes and lights and things and, you know, a bit dreamlike kind of scenes.
Yeah. I think for me, like, working on that sort of game, I really, not only I had to adapt my style to the scenes that I had to paint, but I also had to, like, I got the chance to adapt, like, the game also to my style. Like, if you play Blackwell, you'll notice that New York is suddenly bright emerald green, which New York certainly isn't, you know. But for me, that was just my way of making my little mark on the game, you know. And I like New York in some very strange colors, but I always try and do it in a way that feels sensible and fitting. But yeah, I had a lot to learn. But also, as an artist, you always want to put your own touch. Like, especially for me, coming in, like, in the fifth entry in a series to suddenly do the backgrounds, and you've got four games coming beforehand, all of which are all... As somebody that's not an artist, to look at them, you go, oh, they're all low-res pixel art. You know, they all look the same. Mm-hmm. But as an someone with an artist's eye, you'll go, wow, they're all very, very different stylistically.
Yeah, so they are.
I can probably get away with, you know, doing things a little differently. You know, if you look at Convergence, most of the scenes that's an absolutely beautiful game, and I looked at it a lot. But I wonder if I can do something similar to this, but a little more colorful and also a little darker, because I paint quite dark.
Yes,
and,
you do.
Yeah.
And that's one thing which you immediately see if you take like the very first room. I haven't played Epiphany yet, but I've seen the scenes where they're standing in a room and there's a big opening. Yes. And you have a traditional room, but the painting, it's clear that you haven't used this standard draw box, make it in perspective, fill it with stuff. Guys, sorry, I'm just going to close the door here a second.
No worries.
Yeah. What he said.
Sorry.
Exactly. No worries.
You can edit that out, I guess.
No, we don't edit anything out. It's all going in.
Okay.
We're very experimental podcasters.
We'll see, Francisco.
Yeah. Just you wait. You know, I'm tempted.
That's a dare.
Oh, you want to dare me? I'm actually considering putting in the general newbie song at the end of the podcast.
Oh no!
If it's still online anymore,
don't do that.
No, I won't do that. I'll No.
Thank you. I think I was trying to make a point here. About the background drawing process. I don't know why I'm over analyzing your art.
That's fine. I won't cry.
Okay. No. But you. No. It's a good thing as well. No. It's obvious that you didn't have that approach to it, because I was sick and tired of my own procedure of, you know, making this 3D kind of box and fill it with stuff that would look. That would be in the correct perspective and everything. And in your rooms, you don't have this distinct box feeling, because you don't always see very many corners even, or edges, or mm-hmm. It's like it's you, and I'm very impressed by that. It feels like ordinary interiors, like it feels like offices and whatever, but you don't have that many straight lines. Simply, you don't have these box like shapes everywhere, which I'm very impressed by.
Thank you.
And even some where you have floor tiles.
Yeah,
they're not necessarily in perspective, but I mean it's nice.
I actually sort of said to myself, because when I started working on the game, Dave had sort of said to me when we were doing Deception, he said, oh, you know, if you'd like to do the backgrounds for Deception, you know, the job's yours. And I was not confident at all. I said, oh, I won't be able to do justice to the game, you know. But when he asked me about Epiphany, you know, I was a lot more, you know, a year or a year and a half or whatever is a long time when it comes to developing your skills. So, mm-hmm. you know, I was a lot more confident. But one thing I knew, like, I'd play the Black Rock games, I'd play the Civ, I know how Dave designs games, and I thought, I'm going to have to draw an entire game of offices and lobbies and apartments. Mm-hmm. That's how Dave designed. You know, he's a very sort of real-world kind of guy when it comes, well, mm-hmm. to an extent. But so I said to myself, you know, what I need to do, and Francisco will vouch for this because he knows this, when I was walking around Sydney, you know, I would look for offices and apartments and stuff, but look for ones that look really interesting, because people design, architects are artists as well, you know, and I try and look for things that are interesting to me that still look like an office, but mm-hmm. have something else going for them. And there's a couple of things like, and there's other times where I knew that if I did something in perspective, there's a TV studio in the game. And if anybody, like, in the Critics Lounge got their usual, you know, perspective lines and tried to meet them all up, they'd probably have a nightmare. But for a casual observer who doesn't really care about that, you know, it actually, I think, helps the scene not following perspective at all, mm-hmm. as long as you know how to hide that. Because if you don't hide it well, yeah, you fail, basically. But yeah, there's a line, I think. You have to try and work within your own style and what's comfortable for you, but also, in my case, you know, what Dave wants. Dave wants me to draw New York. So
yes.
You got to find the compromise there. And I guess you were saying... Yeah.
There is, as you say, there is a line where you can't... Because since we're not using photographs, and even if we had used photographs, we would still have to arrange stuff and model things to make it read like. And if you would take a picture of a just any office somewhere, it would be very messy, and it wouldn't look like anything we put in our games, because mm-hmm. to some extent we need the readability. We need to have a room which is fairly conventional, and we need to have the open space where the character can walk, and we need to have things in the background and some things like in the foreground, and that's our task as graphic designers. We have to find a balance between depicting reality and drawing symbols, because most people, beginners, will always draw symbols, basically. That's like if you say to someone, can you draw a tree, and they will pick up the brown crayon and make the trunk, and then they will pick up the green Crayon, and they will make a huge, you know, the crown.
Like broccoli, basically.
Yes, brown.
Yeah, brown stem broccoli. Yeah.
So we always have the mental symbols of what things look like, and we had that discussion over at the Critics Lounge with, again, Snarky.
Yes,
drawing trees, and he was well aware of the fact that trees aren't typically brown / bright green. And if you take a look at any forest, you will see that for yourself. But if let's say that I want a forest scene in my game, I can't just go outside, take a photo of a forest and put it in the game, because it would be too, you know, it would just be a jumbled mess of lines and shapes and grass, and it would be really hard to read. So there's always this. You always have you will always have to compromise. Where, going from the child symbol, the representation of something, to the harsh reality, sort of.
Yeah, you want to be able to have something that looks believable, but also it's a structured composition where people can interact with it and sort of understanding inherently what everything is, where the exits are, you know, what's usable, that sort of thing. Yeah. Understand. That
take any lobby or office in Epiphany. And there's a room and there's a desk and it's strategically positioned, sort of turned to the viewer. It's easy to access, etc. And you will find that many offices are just some kind of weird open landscape with shapes and lines and distracting things everywhere, and so you have to accept that what you do is a representation of something. It's not what it really looks like.
Yeah, very true. But I think you were talking about the looking at a tree and drawing it as a symbol. I think in that case you can still make something look like a tree, but give it different colors to, you know, how you expect. You know, I think still looking at photographs and reference pictures and things like that is still an essential part of designing your game, because we do sort of assume that we know what things look like when we go to draw them a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I just Friday night I painted a butterfly and as a gift for someone, and I thought I know how to draw a butterfly. You know, so I looked at a couple of pictures and I started painting away, and then I was having a lot of trouble with it, and I looked at some more reference pictures, and I had to stop and go over some of the stuff that I painted, because I realized I have no idea what a butterfly looks like, because I've glanced at them, I've never studied them. And it's the same with a lot of things you find yourself drawing, you know. Mm-hmm. You'll have glanced at apartment buildings because you use them every day, you know, and doors and things like that, but you don't always take notice of what makes them interesting.
Yeah, and we have, the funny thing is that nobody has a problem identifying or recognizing a butterfly. So there's a huge discrepancy between recognizing something and being able to recreate it or depict it. That's a very interesting thing. Like, even a child knows perfectly well what a butterfly looks like, and they would be able to say, no, that's not a real butterfly. But when you, even as a fully functional adult, when you sit down and you...
Take that, children!
even with all that, and you sit down and you say to yourself, what does a butterfly actually look like? And if you don't have, like, a few... It's like, I don't know how many horses I've drawn, but like anyone who tries to be a good artist, I probably draw a horse, at least a couple of horses a week, even though I don't have to draw horses, even though I don't like horses or drawing them or intend to use them in my game, I still draw the damn horses. And just to get this eye finger thing where I try to remember what makes a horse a horse. Oh yeah, the head is attached there, and you have the legs, they are bent in a funny way, and you have all the things and the hard thing is translating or transferring your knowledge of something to the paper. Obviously, maybe I'm just saying obvious things now, but sometimes it's a bit fascinating to feel this sense of being completely handicapped in that way. I know inside what it should look like, but for the life of me, I can't do it.
My biggest frustration, and I'm sure it's a frustration for a lot of artists, is never being able to get, or when you have a perfect visualization in your mind of what you want something to look like, and then just not being able to get it out at all. Like, it happens to me with curtains all the time. I know what curtains look like. I know how folds and fabric work, but I cannot for the life of me get decent looking folds and fabric without looking at a reference.
No.
So, yeah.
That's why in like 90% of the interiors in my game, there aren't any curtains, just naked walls. And the Bergwall estate, if you look closely, looks extremely naked and cold because there aren't any curtains everywhere. Anyway, I was just too frustrated, and then I started adding curtains later to some scenes, just to because windows, they typically have curtains.
I just remembered something I was gonna say, that I don't know if you played Bertha Butts Boogie. I wouldn't blame you if you didn't, but it made me laugh because the texture inside for the wallpaper in I forget his name. The guy who you have to do the investigation in the church for.
Jorgen.
Yeah. The wallpaper on the inside of his apartment, you used like the exact same texture that I used in one of the of the rooms in Bertha. But yeah, but you made you made yours a little bit more monochromatic than. But I recognized the flower pattern, and I was like, hey. Cool.
I think it's just a picture of a wallpaper somewhere. I don't think it's like a SketchUp texture.
I got mine from cgtextures.com.
Oh, all right. Okay, maybe I did then. I just wanted something horrible and something ugly. like they would use in the 70s.
Yeah.
And Jorgen obviously wouldn't refurnish his house.
Yeah.
He's not that kind of guy.
I like how you made the Samaritan Paradox a period piece and didn't go for that whole, hey, we're in the 80s, ha ha ha. I think maybe like the only place where you skirted on that was the art gallery, but that's fun because making fun of art gallery.
What about the David Lee Roth lookalike in the cafe?
Oh, that guy was cool, yeah.
That guy was my favorite part. Head banging away with his golden mullet, that was excellent.
Yeah.
You don't
sound very pleased, Andrew.
I don't know.
What was your inspiration for that, to set it in the 80s, out of curiosity?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to work out. I didn't go for the aesthetics. I'm not very like into the style or anything like that, but it's more of the mentality, I guess, because if you take Sweden in the early 80s, you would have a lot of this this moral, you know, the game, one theme is that you have Sweden exporting weapons, and that's based on real, I mean, that's what we do, and it's shameful, obviously, because we try to be a neutral country, and we enjoy mediating, you know, in the Middle East, and we take ourselves very seriously in that respect, and then we still give them bombs. so that double standard and is something I wanted to portray, and especially I think in this era, Sweden, there was this, I think there was this naivety and this kind of innocence where we weren't fully aware of perhaps our role, and Sweden has always had very good, you know, self-confidence, and we've always seen ourselves as some kind of, you know, example in the world. Mm-hmm. Before we had the internet and that kind of communication, I guess this feeling was perhaps even stronger. I could have even set the game in the 60s, because then I guess that was the peak of being, you know, morally being this self-conscious about morality and politics and things like that. But then it would be, I mean, that was the case for everyone in the 60s. You had the political movements, you know, the hippie era and later on. So I didn't want that, but I wanted a period where things were uncomplicated and where people were a bit like naive. That's a theme. So I didn't want the internet, for instance. Mm. So I guess that was that, basically. I wanted this dull, not deserted, but a bit desolate feeling of an urban, grey, very, very ugly and badly planned city that is.
That's very patriotic in a backhanded way that you made a game about the place, but then you didn't like that. But it worked. It definitely worked. You know, it felt it was very immersive setting.
Yeah. So even though, yeah, like I said, it didn't hammer it over the head that it was like, hey, we're the 80s. It's in the 80s. Yeah, like you could have easily have done.
Mm-hmm.
Warrant songs playing on the stereo and stuff like that.
Yeah, and like, yeah, everybody in shoulder pads with giant hair.
Yeah,
there are a few shoulder pads, I guess.
Well, like I said,
and a few mullets, and hairsprayed bangs being everywhere. But I didn't want to go overboard. It's not a comedy, and I didn't want to distract the player. Yeah.
No, it's a very nice subtle way of establishing a time and a place, which I think it's good, because you don't want to go too heavy-handed with that sort of thing. I actually one other thing I wanted to ask. I know you said you use SketchUp for your backgrounds. For your actual real world location exterior shots that we talked about before, did you use photo references, or did you just kind of?
No, I definitely used photo references, yes.
Cool.
And that's a bit of a tedious process, which I don't really enjoy.
Yeah.
You take a photo and you have to trace everything, and then you have to you basically have to redraw it, because it in a low res pixely kind of art style, you don't want anything to look too photorealistic. It would just ruin everything.
Yeah.
So that and I don't enjoy that. It's a very kind of repetitious thing. You have to draw every window, and you have to make everything kind of straight and nice.
I hate those straight lines.
Yeah.
Especially since there's no line tool in Photoshop anymore. I miss that line tool so much. But shift click just isn't the same, because you have to know where you're clicking. Doesn't give you any sort of visual indication that you're off. So I have to go back and
But anyway. Yeah, sometimes it's a bit clumsy.
Yeah.
So that's why my next game won't have straight lines. Basically, it's just going to be none.
That's one nice thing about the game that Francisco and I are working on together. The straight lines are all where I decide to put them. It's all, you know, you've got a bombed out wasteland. If I decide that wall's just shred, I just make it look like it's been smashed to pieces, and it's fantastic. There's a huge hole in it, you know, there's cracks. It's perfect.
Yeah.
Rubble piled up against it.
Yeah. I envy you in that. and I want, that's what I want to pursue this time.
This
complete freedom of just making things non-straight.
It's a very liberating way of setting out a composition, because you can know exactly where your focal point is, and you never have to compromise because of perspective or anything like that. You can just go for it. Mm-hmm. And I like that a lot.
Yeah.
So,
can you give us a tease of what your next project is going to be, or is it still too early to say?
Oh well, it's extremely early, because I don't know anything.
Oh okay.
I just which also means that I can say anything, and it won't Sure.
Yeah.
It's non-binding.
Oh, okay.
No, it's this podcast is in no way form a legal instrument, so you say whatever you like.
Mm-hmm. As I said, I wanted to make something, or I want to make something very, very kind of bare in a sense, very, very naked in terms of backstory and relations everywhere, and even story. I want there to be a story present, but not perhaps all necessarily as a part of the gameplay. I was very inspired by Braid recently. I haven't played it, but I've read about it, and I've seen it on YouTube, Let's Plays of Braid, and I was I think you know what I'm talking about.
Jonathan Blow.
Yeah.
And where there is a story, and it's a good story, I believe, and he made a platformer out of it, and I also want to have I want there to be a story somewhere. But I don't want the story to be told or explained within the game necessarily. I want that. I want them to be, because you have in Braid, as far as I've tried it a little, and I was a bit disappointed because the story wasn't.
It's a platformer.
It's a platformer which is just like any platformer, but there, somewhere above that, on some kind of meta level, you have a story, and I'm very impressed by the way he managed to make the player think that the game has a story, when in reality there are some books scattered around and there are some texts in them, but it got me very I was very inspired by that effect, basically, to do something and then perhaps later on or intermittently feel that what you do represents something. It's a metaphor for something. So I'm probably going to do something that has a very, very it's very symbolic. Perhaps you're just walking through a forest and you don't necessarily engage in dialogues, or you don't necessarily interact with things in a clever way, and you don't combine inventory objects, but whatever you do, it will represent something in a kind of ulterior story, basically.
So you're kind of going more towards the Tale of Tales approach,
which I don't know what it is.
did you ever play The Path or hear about The Path?
Nope. As I said, I'm a bit embarrassed, but I don't play that many games.
It's fine. I don't play that many games anymore either. Well, the path is a I guess it's an adventure game. It's not really an adventure game.
It's a walking simulator.
Yeah, it is. Basically, you play this old lady in a cemetery, and you walk down the path, and then you sit on a bench, and that's the game. And there's DLC which you can buy in which she dies. When she sits on the bench.
I don't want to make a game that's
that's a bit of an extreme example. But
that's
exaggerated. It's very exaggerated. But I'm just talking about that, you know, the whole minimalist approach to it.
Yeah, I get. I'm very afraid to make something that people will, oh, this is some kind of, you know, highbrow experiment, and you obviously have to be very kind of intellectual to get all the references. I definitely don't want to do that. on the contrary, I want to do something that's much easier, much more accessible than Samaritan Paradox was, because that's rather hard to sort of get into. I want to do something that's entertaining in its gameplay as well. I don't want it to be that existential. I also know about this. You have a game where you basically just walk down the street and you enter a cafe and you order a coffee.
Dinner Date.
Oh, is that Dinner Date? Okay.
I think so, yeah.
It's a Canadian game, I think.
Okay.
So I don't want that. I want a proper game with proper gameplay, but I don't want to tell a story. I just want the story to be there and to okay. kind of, yeah. It's a bit hard to say, but in terms of graphics, I've already started and I know it will be. I've hand painted a few scenes and I'm going to work with them in Photoshop and there will be a much more emphasis on the visuals this time.
When you say hand painted, you mean you've drawn them?
Yeah, hand drawn. I should say. Okay. Yeah. Cool. Sorry. Yeah. So I will color them in.
Right. They're going to be Photoshop. Right. They're scanned art. Cool.
Yeah. So I will work like that, and even, I know that some people were some feedback I got from players of the Samaritan Paradox said that it was very nice to have a strong emphasis on the story and the puzzles and not to be that obsessed by cute visuals, but nevertheless, this time around, I'm going to be much more visual and much less textual, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want people, because even though I know that I don't want people to be able to say things like why is this low res when nowadays you can make something blah blah blah. I know it's a very silly argument to make or a silly remark to make, because the retro style entails low res graphics, but I don't want that to be a potential minus point for critics or people.
Yeah, sure. People are always going to say stuff about low res art because people are idiots.
Well,
yeah,
it's a valid point for a certain audience, you know. I think
for this idiot audience.
Okay. Yes, as I like to call them on my blog, not. I agree with you, but at one point, I think it was Theodore Wern who you I think
yes.
you I early on I met him in Gothenburg.
Who is Swedish? Yes, which you can confirm. And yes, I realize my faux pas now. I thought he was Dutch, but he's not.
I wasn't going to bring up your error.
Well, I do. I fully accept it and embrace
He's owned
it. Correct it. Yeah, I own it.
Yeah. But early on, I met with him in Gothenburg, and we had a lunch and just to discuss my game basically and to get some good advice, and I and he basically said, which is I guess a very obvious thing, like read critics, read reviews by critics that you respect and accept and expect to write about your game, and look at the minus points, the good or the bad mm-hmm. things, because typically critics they have their pet peeves and they have things that they will typically put there. They won't always invent the wheel again. They will put things like no voices or low res or they will have their typical things,
mm-hmm.
yeah, on the minus sure. side. And what you want to do is that you want to kind of prevent that from happening. You want to basically, if you're looking for, there are some easy things that you can sort of prevent people from complaining about. And I've already heard enough of the low res part, and I'm just a bit fed up by it, basically.
Yeah,
fair enough. Actually, Theo himself sort of, I won't say begged, but he wrote some very determined emails to me, sort of saying, you know, over and over again, you know, come on, you have to move away from low res. But for me, animating in high resolution is not at the moment something I'm practical enough with.
No,
you know, it's not something I have enough skill on doing. So,
and I think it's a bit sad, and it feels completely like futile to say something like, but I find this attractive, because I don't think that high res is like automatically better than low res, but it's such a, it feels like you're just defending something, like making excuses for something, and I'm not prepared to go there again. So I'm not that I've gone into some kind of argument, like a quarrel about that, or I haven't officially said that, look, I want my game to look this way, because I find it attractive to look at, because I just realize that I'm the one being in a kind of a niche group of people who have a, you know, this preference, which is just becoming rarer. But yeah, so if you would ask me personally, I definitely think that it's a well-made 320 times 200 pixel background can be a complete masterpiece in its own. But you just want to I guess reach out to a different crowd.
Sure. And also, I think there's certain things you can do with high res that you just can't do with low res. But I would say the opposite is true. There's certain effects that I know I can get away with in low res that I cannot imagine getting away with some of the stuff I do in high resolution, you know? So I think there'll always be a benefit and a sort of, you know, downside to any stylistic choice you make. And I'm definitely interested at some point in moving away from low resolution, because I love the low-res style, and, you know, and I still play a lot of games from the 90s which are in that resolution, so I have that natural affinity with them. They're games that I loved then, and there's games that I still love now, and new games that I find that I still love, but I also love high-resolution graphics. I love seeing really good digital painters, you know. I look a lot at great digital painters, and I go, I wish I could paint like that. I wish I could animate like that. I wish I could, you know, have that style. So I don't think it's a bad thing to try and push yourself. I'm always trying to push myself.
Yeah, but as you say, you're moving to completely different territory, and what you do when you have a high res painting. I know these I don't know the names, but you have these. Is it Telltale? No, it's not Telltale. It's
Daedalic. Yeah.
And they make these. Is it a Silent World or a Whisper World?
A Whisper World.
They've
got a lot of games. Yeah.
And obviously their backgrounds, they are completely gorgeous. They are super detailed. And
look at Memora. That's that's a stunning game.
And I feel even when I say this to myself, I feel like I'm being a bit of a hypocrite, but I am not very intrigued by it. I don't know why, but I'm not very fascinated. And I think it's because, when I grew up, I played Police Quest 1, and it's so pixelated, you don't even see what people look like. You just have to make... You have to make mental images of faces.
Your car is a 2-pixel red white thing. Yeah.
And very easy
to crash.
Yeah, and it's almost like reading a book, in the sense that you have to create all the imagery on your own. And I even remember very, very clearly when I had played Leisure Suit Larry 1 or 2 or whichever, and I move, and suddenly years later I played the 5th game or something. I think it was the one in the hotel or this spa place.
That was 6.
Yeah, and suddenly Larry was some kind of cartoon character with his enormous head, and he was balding, and he looked, he had this silly, he was doing this silly face all the time. And when I played Larry 1, maybe partly because I was very young, but to me that was a rather serious game. It was dark, and it didn't strike me as a cartoon. It had alcohol and prostitutes, and you didn't really combine anything with anything. As far as I remember, you basically used a hammer on a window to smash it. That was a puzzle in
Yeah, but don't forget you also had to tie yourself to a balcony with a rope that you got from a bed.
Yeah. Yeah. So to me, Larry was a miserable old man in a kind of a realistic context.
Okay. Oh man!
And then suddenly he turned out to be this cartoon character with an enormous head, and for me that just it just ruined it for me. So
you know how they had the Leisure Suit Larry 1 Reloaded, which wasn't all that well received. Maybe it would have been better received if they had gone like the dark, gritty reboot way, and it had just been like a really depressing thing about this sad old man who's just like, I want to be loved.
Yeah.
No one loves me.
I wonder.
Yeah. Because the opposite is. Yeah, sorry.
I wonder if your perception of Larry was slightly based on the fact that you're in 1980s Sweden at the time, and that altered your perception.
But perhaps also the fact that the opposite is just too. I mean, making a comedy out of a middle-aged man, I guess he's middle-aged. You know, just walking around trying to score, basically, and making a comedy out of it is just. Perhaps I just try to save the game from being a really, really stupid comedy to being about. Yeah, being about a sad old man being very desperate.
I love that. I love that take on it. I love. Yeah. No, oh man!
I want to see that game now. I want to see me too, Larry.
Me too.
As a like some grumbling old man.
Yeah.
That'd be way more interesting.
Yeah. It would be. It would actually add depth to this to the character and the story instead of just like, oh, haha, let's make fun of him because he's old and
his hips now fractured.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, and then he has to go to the hospital, and they're like, your insurance won't cover this Leisure Suit Larry. He's like, no.
Yeah. And also, it's the same with the Police Quest, which I keep returning to. But I mean, that was very real for me. And it's funny how I was it Laura, his colleague, the female. I think.
I think Laura.
And then there is this prostitute which he eventually, I guess, hooks up with.
Yeah.
Is it Mary? Mary or Sarah's?
Sweet Cheeks Marie.
Oh, Marie. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And I, this is funny, but more memories from my early teens. But we played this a bunch of boys, and I guess we were 12. And I remember us having having a debate on who was more attractive, Marie or Laura. And we were kind of disappointed that he didn't go for Laura instead, because she was in our minds she was more attractive.
She was blonde and she had.
And I don't think there was even a close up of her. So I guess because of that. So it's just all the imagery that you had to evoke or conjure somehow in within you. I think that's a much more powerful thing than having perfect. And that, but back to Theo, that was the reason for him doing all the masks, because you have all these African tribal masks for character portraits, because even though that was not that high risk, but even as a close-up character, he didn't want to instruct the player how to perceive, how to picture the character. It would be impossible to make a real face that would like be not be just, you know, that wouldn't ruin people's interpretation or people's imagination.
Interesting.
So we obviously I made dialogue portraits for my game, which I regret. I think I should have gone for just making some kind of rudimentary talking animations where they, you know, wobble their heads a bit and gesticulate.
I tweeted the other day that watching Let's Plays of your games is probably the worst thing you could ever do. More than the reason I put a few of my games on Game Jolt, because someone was like, you should put your games on Game Jolt. So I did, and for some reason people on Game Jolt like doing Let's Plays really fast. So they commented on them like, oh, I did a Let's Play of your game. And so I checked out a Let's Play that someone did of The Rebirth and The Reaper, and the very first thing that he complained about, because he hated both games and he was just screaming the whole time, why would you do this? It's stupid. One of the first things that he complained about was the fact that the characters bobbed their heads when they spoke, and he was like, people don't talk like that! That's not... And I was just, oh, you've never played LucasArts games.
Yeah, I know. There was, very early on, I think just like 2 days after the release, there was a lady doing a Let's Play on TSP. And thankfully now there are complete playthroughs so that people won't have to look at her video. Because it was like, I guess it was not only her first adventure game, but perhaps her first game in quite a while, she was basically just being very, very frustrated. You should look at that. It's entertaining, and can't find anything. She can't find the inventory bar control, which is, I mean, I guess you can't expect that people read the manual, but she hovers with a cursor over like stuff, and then suddenly she sees Ord, and she goes like, what is this? What's an Ord? I'm an American. I don't know what an Ord is.
God.
she hadn't even like read the first three lines where he introduces himself. So sometimes you wonder why people even bother.
Because games are very cheap, like, compared to, like, man, when I was a kid, you know, you'd buy a game, that was your game for the month, you know, whereas people now, they'll see a game and they go, oh, you know, that's, I'll pick that up, you know, it's on pre-order bonus or it's in a bundle. And you see people buy games that they'd never otherwise play if they had to pay $60 for the game. So I think it's become a lot more accessible for people, instead of going, you know, I tried an adventure game at a friend's house, that's the genre I like, I'll seek more of that out. They go, oh, this game's got a pre-order bonus, I'll get it for the trading cards or whatever on Steam, you know, that sort of thing. So I think I've definitely noticed that trend. You know, people get an iPhone game for $3, play it for 2 minutes and go, oh, this was a waste of money. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you'd bought that exact same game with those exact same graphics back when I was playing games as a kid in 1995 or whatever, you'd go, man, this is amazing, I'll play this for hours.
So and also there weren't any walkthroughs or anything, so you would have to... When you got stuck in 92, you were literally stuck. We played Police Quest 1 for a year, or maybe even more, and we would sometimes play it together, sometimes we would play it on our own, and we would like call each other, and did you solve that yet? And oftentimes, no. So I remember even calling the American telephone number. The hospital.
Wow. Oh God, not the hit number.
And I don't think I managed to, because they wouldn't have that kind of service abroad.
Probably would have cost $70 or something to get through.
Yeah, so just realizing how much time and effort people spent on games back then, and how patient people were.
Even
playing ridiculous games like the King Quest series, where you die all the time just to extend the play time, basically.
I recently played through King's Quest V for the very first time, and Francisco was there, and I'm a pretty patient gamer, and I'm not a walkthrough user, and I like figuring stuff out myself, but I found myself quite frustrated, especially towards the very last part of the game. I'm like, how did anybody stick with this? You know, the only reason I stuck with it is because I had cheerleaders on Skype going, come on, you can do it, you can do it. And I'm going, oh, I just want to give up. I just don't want to play this anymore, you know?
But even those are some pretty games, though. Where is it?
Oh, yeah, beautiful, stunning game.
Is that the one with Alexander? And it's narrated in some kind of third person.
No, that's number six, which is
even prettier. I think it's really beautiful. That's the height of low res background sceneries.
Some really, really nice vistas. I love taking screenshots of those old games, and
even though most of the puzzles, at least in the beginning in King's Quest VI, they were good and kind of entertaining. But even in that game, you have some dead ends, and also they tended to be like there wasn't an inherent speed regulator, something. So if you played it on a more powerful computer, some events tended to just skip. And I got stuck. Like, I don't think I've ever finished King's Quest VI, even though it's a game I love the game because it's so beautiful and so on. But I've never even finished it.
Yeah, well, I've never finished Discworld, and I sort of like Discworld. I've tried to finish it over like a span of, I don't know, 17 years or something. But every time I get there, I get to a point where I go, I just can't solve these puzzles, and I don't use walkthroughs. So I sit there and I look at it, and I go, I give up. You know, they designed some crazy games back in the day.
Yes.
So even I remember The Secret of Monkey Island. There's a bit where you're stuck on the ship and you have to open the cereal box.
Yeah,
instead of using it or anything.
Exactly.
I was stuck there for like 2 months or something.
Yeah.
You know? I'm like, and when I finally got it, I'm like, oh, I'm an idiot. You know? Yeah. But I remember writing letters to like Maxis and writing letters to like Acclaim Software and stuff, asking for like help with the games. You write a letter and then 2 months later you get a letter back, and if they don't answer your hint properly, you know, you got to send them another. It used to take forever. We were so patient back in the day. And nowadays, you know, you just go, I look at my shelf, I've got, like, so many games. I just go, I'll play something else. This is too hard. This sucks. Yeah. This game's dumb.
Even when it's obviously a method to just extend the time, especially in Police Quest, you have various dead ends that they were just designed to make you restart and try it again, just to make it last longer.
Ever try taking off your clothes in Police Quest 1?
Yes.
That was the stupidest death ever.
I tried many things that killed me in Police Quest. I tried pulling the prostitute's number. It was another. You stop the woman, and she gave you her number.
And
if you called it, it turned out to be the lieutenant's wife or something. Yeah.
How did she get that number? There's so many unanswered questions.
Yes.
Well, anyway, I think we should probably wrap things up because we're getting close to the 2-hour mark, which is our longest podcast ever. You're on our record length podcast. Oh. So, if people want to follow you and your work, where can they find you, Petter?
They can always find me on the AGS forums, because I intend to stay there as a regular, and I will presently display my the graphics for my next project.
Okay.
Good. At least some kind of little bite of it.
Good. Yeah. Didn't you also recently got Twitter?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's one of those things that people say it's a must have, and I still don't really understand why I must have it, and I don't really know what the difference is between Twitter and Facebook. I guess you can be even less careful with what you say on Twitter.
There's a lot less BuzzFeed articles on Twitter,
and also you don't have to be friends with people; they can follow you without you having to do anything with them. So that's kind of nice.
Well, maybe I'm being a bit. I don't know. I'm ridiculing it a bit. But I do have it. And I also have my blog, which I, like any other blogger, I'll say that I'll try to update it more.
I promise I'll update.
Yeah. Sure. And where can we find these things?
The blog is at Faravid Interactive and then WordPress.com. It's the WordPress server. And my Twitter account, I'm not really sure. Is it?
It's your name. It's your full name.
Yeah,
I believe
it is. Because there was some kind of. It says my name, and then it says at, and then it says my name again. and this time, the last T is missing. So I don't know if that does anything. But
I'm not sure.
I'll probably have to fix that.
You'll figure it out.
Yes.
Yeah. And if you'd like to buy the Samaritan Paradox, you can find it on GOG, on Steam, and you can find it on the Screen 7 website, I believe, and a bunch of other places.
Yeah, it has a homepage that's samaritanparadox.co.uk.
Beautiful.
Good.
Yeah, and you can even order a DVD box from there, which is...
Oh, there you go.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
All of our listeners... As we instructed them, already went out and played it before listening to this podcast because, you know, we did tell them, and they are our sort of thralls. So,
exactly.
I will check the sales figures later to verify this statement.
Well, hopefully they've already bought it, being good adventure game players as they are.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So, yeah, I know I've nagged a few people personally to buy it because that's the kind of guy I am.
Yeah,
I think it's a decent game and people should absolutely play it. You know, there's a lot to see in there and a lot to enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And lots of places to get stuck,
which is the hallmark of any good adventure game. Anyway, so you can follow Ben at Ben_304. You can follow me at Gurnislav Games. You can follow the Blue Cup Tools podcast at @BCT_podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, which I've forgotten to mention for like the past 16 episodes or so. I keep forgetting we're on iTunes. So, yes, thank you for listening. Andale, Petter, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome back anytime you like to talk about anything you like.
Oh, that would be awesome. Yeah.
Yes, so... thank you, and thank you, listeners, and everyone say goodbye.
Cheerio.